Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, and podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. And we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'm very happy now to welcome Dan Flores. He is a historian of the West. He's a professor at the University of Montana at Missoula, and he's the author of many books, including a new one called Visions of the Big Sky, Painting and Photography of the Northern Rocky Mountain West. And he's going to be speaking this coming Saturday, the 12th of June at 3 o'clock at Garcia Street Books. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
It's a great pleasure to be here. Thank you.
So this is also, not only are you presenting your new book, but one of your older books has also been reissued. It's called Cap Rock Canyonlands, Journeys into the Heart of the Southern Plains. So one is about the art of the Northern Rocky Mountains, and one is about the land of the southern plains and canyons that extend from New Mexico into Texas. Is that right?
That's correct, yes. And that's in part, I think, a result of having lived in both those places. I lived for about 14 or 15 years on the southern high plains when I taught over at Texas Tech and West Texas. And then in the early 1990s, I went to the University of Montana. So I think probably what both those books represent is an inclination I seem to have to write about places where I'm living.
Yeah. Well, I find it fascinating. You come from Louisiana, and you have been drawn by fate or teaching opportunities or whatever to these very rocky and mountainous places, so different from where you come from.
So different, yeah. I think in Cap Rock Canyonlands, which was initially written more than 20 years ago, I kind of grappled with that a little bit. Growing up in these very verdant, lush, humid settings, I mean, my family has been from Louisiana for almost 300 years. But for some reason, and I kind of speculated about that a little bit in the book, I've always been drawn to the West. And so it's a natural progression for me somehow to find the arid West, the dry, the sere landscapes of the West, and the vertical landscapes of the Rockies to have a lot stronger pull on me, I think, somehow, than my own home environs.
Yeah, it's funny how that happens with whatever the thing is. Sometimes we're drawn to music of a completely different place or land of a different place of our than our own origins. The new book, let's talk about that for a little bit, Visions of the Big Sky, Painting and Photography of the Northern Rocky Mountain West. How far back does the visual art tradition in the West, in the Northern Rocky Mountains, what are we talking about, Montana?
Well, basically, the way I design books geographically is to do them by natural landform rather than political boundaries. So this particular book is about a region called the Northern Rockies, which essentially starts with the Wind River Range in southwestern Wyoming and extends up into the Alberta Rockies. But the book more or less centers around Montana and Idaho, I think, probably most of the artists, because of the presence of national parks who visited the region, were drawn to the state of Montana or very near it. So it's a book essentially about this arts tradition that, in my interpretation, goes back 8,000 years. I mean, the book begins with rock art images of what's called the Dinwoody tradition in the Great Basin, of the Wyoming Basin, I should say, of Wyoming. And some of those rock images go back almost 8,000 years in time. But, I mean, there's, to be quite honest, pretty much a focus in the book on the 19th and probably three-quarters of the 20th century. Basically about a 200-year stretch is where most of the images come from.
How does the imagery of the Northern Rocky Mountains and the Southern Rocky Mountains here in northern New Mexico, for example, we're kind of at the other end of the mountain chain, how do those images differ and why?
Well, that's a great question, Mary Charlotte, because, as you know from reading the book, one of the things I do with it is to compare the art tradition of the northern end of the Rockies with the art tradition of the southern end of the Southwest in particular. And I think one of the reasons I did that is because I also live here. I have a home just outside Santa Fe. So I've known about art and the Southwestern art tradition for a long time, and pretty much had that in my head when I first began working on this project, which was back in the middle of the 1990s. And so what I try to do with this book is to show really how these two regions of the West offer up a kind of a different aesthetic. I mean, in one of the chapters in this book, it's the last chapter, in fact, it's called What Was Charlie Russell Trying to Tell Us? I argue that the only two places in the West that sort of have artists as their patron figures, citizens, are New Mexico and Montana. In New Mexico, of course, it's George O'Keefe. In Montana, it's Charlie Russell. And one of the arguments I develop out of that is that Charlie Russell, in his tradition, has given us a kind of a northern art world that's really a masculine world of big wilderness, big charismatic animals, while George O'Keefe and the Southwestern arts tradition is much more a kind of a feminine, mystical desert interpretation. And in a nutshell, that's kind of the difference, really, between the two.
Why is there such a difference? Does it come from the land? Is it a coincidence?
Well, it does come from the land in part, I think, because if you experience those two worlds, and I experience them all the time because I commute back and forth between Missoula and Santa Fe, the Northern Rockies is a sort of a much cooler, bluer, greener kind of landscape, for one thing.
There's just more water there.
There's more water. I mean, it's arid. Missoula only gets 13 inches of precipitation a year. I mean, that's only 4 inches more than Santa Fe gets. So they're both arid landscapes, but because evaporation is not as high in the Northern Rockies, you get sort of a greener, bluer kind of world, as opposed to what I think of as kind of the yellow-red orientation of the Southwest. So there is a very much a visual kind of difference, which I think the artists, many of whom worked in both regions, a lot of the artists I cover in this book are famous in the Southwest, but they also ended up going to the Northern Rockies and painting. And so they saw these two different regions. But I think part of it has to do with the different traditions of the native people in the Northern Rockies and in the Southwest. And, I mean, there's an awful lot of Indian art, of course, in both regions. But I argue in this Visions of the Big Sky book that there's a different interpretation in the Northern Rockies. In the Northern Rockies, everyone was concerned a century ago about Buffalo Indians, Plains Indians losing their culture, basically the vanishing Indian. And so the art tradition there, when it looks at Indians, it sort of does this visual salvage anthropology. Think Edward Sheriff Curtis, for
example.
Where people in the early 20th century are actually trying to portray Indians as they lived 50 or 75 years before. And in the Southwest, I mean, there's much more kind of a, you know, the Pueblos have survived into modern times. They retain their culture. They retain their religion. There's not so much a sense that in order to capture them authentically, you've got to do it the way they existed 100 years before. And that kind of creates a very different sort of interpretation of the two regions.
You also have the Latin Hispanic traditions here that I don't think you have so much up in the Northern Rocky Mountains.
Well, we have a kind of a mixed blood, mixed cultural tradition in the Northern West. It's called Métis, and it's a group of people who were produced by the intermarriage of primarily French and Scottish fur traders with the native peoples of the Northern Plains, particularly the Crees and the Assiniboines. And that group became a very self-conscious people who referred to themselves as Métis, mixed people, had blended cultures. But they didn't, for whatever the reason, attract quite the artistic attention that the Hispanic culture of, say, northern New Mexico did from the Taos Society of Artists or the painters in Santa Fe. And I'm not quite sure exactly why that is, except, again, I think that there was a sense in the Southwest that, I mean, as Joseph Henry Sharp himself said, and he's one of these painters who worked in both regions, Sharp said, I'm going to Montana to paint, and he was saying this at the beginning of the 20th century. He would go every summer because, he said, I know Taos is going to last longer. And I think that, for whatever the reason, sort of played into focus on the Hispanic culture in the Southwest, which people thought of as 300 or 400 years old and having survived into the present, whereas the Métis culture seemed to be, to a lot of people, I think, sort of a blip in time. Now, the Métis people haven't gone away by any means, but I think the artists of the early 20th century sort of thought they might.
We're talking to historian of the West, Dan Flores. One of the things that you inevitably have to deal with when you're looking at the art of the West is romanticizing. So you romanticize the Indians who are vanishing. You romanticize the landscape. And then there are people who, artists, who try to look at things really the way they are. Describe some of the examples of both of those things.
Well, those are very potent traditions in the painting of the West in general, I think. And in the Northern Rockies artistic tradition, I think really what's happening is that there are relatively few artists who are trying to show the world as they perceived it at the time they were there. Two of them who did, and who I really admire as a result of it, were Maynard Dixon and probably the guy who was the most famous American portrait painter of his age, of the first half of the 20th century, a German painter named Wienold Reiss. And they both, in some respects, came to that position because of their dissatisfactions with the art of their colleagues. I think Maynard Dixon felt like, after years of working as an illustrator for magazines and portraying the Old West, that, in fact, he even said in a letter to one of his friends that he felt like he was being paid to lie about the West.
Yeah.
And so when he went to Montana, I mean, one of the things he did was he's relatively, I would say, among the few artists who try to portray the Blackfeet as they were living in the years of World War I, rather than trying to do the Edward Sheriff Curtis thing where they're projected back in time. And so, I mean, I use Maynard Dixon on the cover of this book. It's a 1938 oil he did called Home of the Blackfeet, and it shows a Blackfeet home site at the foot of the Rocky Mountain front in Montana. And, of course, there's a teepee there, but there's also a log cabin. Wienold Reiss was one of the painters who was hired by the Great Northern Railroad to create this tourist mecca in Glacier National Park. And just as the railroads in the Southwest used the art of the Taos Society in order to promote tourism, same thing happened with the Northern Pacific in Yellowstone and the Great Northern in Glacier Park. And so the Great Northern in particular, led by a guy who was, he was the son of the founder of that railroad. His name was Louis Hill, and he really sort of understood what the early 20th century advertising century was about, or advertising decades were about. So he hired Wienold Reiss to do these portraits of the Blackfeet in order to use them as posters and even on menus. He did calendars advertising the Great Northern and Glacier Park. But the problem he had with Wienold Reiss is that Wienold Reiss kept wanting to paint the Blackfeet as he saw them rather than this world of the 19th century, the Old West. And so Wienold Reiss is another painter who I regard as being completely honest, but in fact, he ran into trouble with that portrayal.
For being honest,
for showing the Blackfeet. I mean, they dressed in cowboy clothes in the 1920s and 1930s. They wore cowboy hats and calico shirts and cowboy boots. And what the Great Northern wanted him to do was to portray people who were living in teepees and were dressing in traditional clothing.
So this has been going on for a long time.
It has indeed, yeah.
Tell us, who was George Catlin?
Well, George Catlin is a famous figure in the history of the West, and particularly so in the Northern West, because he's a fellow, he's trained as a lawyer in Pennsylvania, who witnessed a group of Plains Indians visiting the East in about 1812, 1814. And this group of people so impressed Catlin that he decided that he was going to be the historian of the American Indian. And so beginning in the early 1830s, he began, he didn't have any money like many artists. He was, in the 19th century especially, he was self-taught. He didn't really have a patron, at least not in the beginning. And so he would hitch rides with steamboats going up the Missouri River to the fur trading posts, and attempted, starting in 1832, to do this complete record in paint, in watercolor primarily, of the Indians of the West. And so he provides us with this kind of remarkable time machine look at Indians on the Missouri River in 1832. I mean, later he came down to the Southwest. He painted in what is now Oklahoma. Even Catlin, later on in his career, went to South America. And so he, in a lot of respects, what he is he's the Edward Sheriff Curtis figure with paint rather than with a camera.
And somewhat earlier.
And somewhat earlier, yes, by something like about 75 years.
Now,
earlier.
The funny thing, one of the interesting things about him is that he was really looked down on by his contemporaries.
Well, he was, because they thought that he was too much of a romantic. I mean, one of the things that got George Catlin in trouble, I think, was that in an age when Indians were not held in high regard in American life, it's, after all, the 1830s is the age when Andrew Jackson is president of the United States, and he's, of course, moving groups like the Cherokees out of the Southeast into the West. Catlin was a great advocate for Indians. In fact, Catlin even personally visited Andrew Jackson when Jackson was president, trying to convince Jackson not to follow through with this removal policy. And so, I mean, he began to get a reputation, even among some of his fellow painters, for being too romantic about Indians, for portraying them too positively. Now, I think with the perspective of 150 years of history, Catlin's star has risen rather dramatically, and that of some of his contemporaries who criticized him for this has fallen a bit, because Catlin sort of seems like, you know, he's an early version of someone who appreciates cultural diversity.
Right, exactly. Well, yeah. I mean, there's not a day that goes by where we don't get a petition, an email to save somebody or some group or something. And here he was doing this 175 or more years ago.
Yeah, he's doing it in the 1830s.
Yeah.
And so, although he was not able to affect that kind of change, he did leave us a visual record of how Native people lived that was very precise and very accurate in terms of material culture. He painted individuals as individual people rather than types. And the notion of painting people as sort of the typical Nez Perce or the typical Blackfeet was very common in the 19th century, even into the early 20th century. And Catlin, he didn't resort to that kind of thing. He represented people as individuals, each of them different one from the other.
And that's a really big deal.
It's a really big deal. I mean, and he even does it with respect to wildlife. I mean, he portrays wildlife sympathetically at a time when most Americans, if they thought of wildlife at all, it was, wildlife is just this kind of lumpen resource that we get to enjoy. And, you know, we can kill as many bison or elk as we want to, and no one has to worry really too much about whether these animals have any kind of sensibility about their deaths. Catlin actually portrays animals who are sensible to those things.
Very interesting. A person ahead of his time.
Very much.
Looked down on, even by people like John James Audubon.
his fellow painter, John James Audubon. Audubon followed Catlin about a decade later up the Missouri River. Audubon had already done his great work, The Birds of North America, and was then working on a book on the mammals of North America. And because he's following in Catlin's footsteps, he feels obliged, and probably also because he thought of Catlin as a rival, he sort of feels obliged to stick his thumb in Catlin's eye at every opportunity. I mean, Audubon will get to a particular Indian village that Catlin had worked in, and Audubon will say, you know, these people don't look anything at all like Mr. Catlin portrayed them.
We're talking to historian of the West, Dan Flores. His new book is called Visions of the Big Sky, Painting and Photographing the Northern Rocky Mountain West. Let's talk for a moment about Audubon. He merits his own chapter. What was his contribution to the art of the Northern Rocky Mountains?
Well, one of the arguments I make in this book is that there is a range of subject matter in the Northern West, in the Northern Rockies, that would be familiar to someone, for example, who knew the artistic tradition in the Southwest, but there would be additions. And one of the additions that I think we don't really much have in the Southwest that's very common in the Northern Rockies is art of the charismatic large animal. The tradition of painting grizzly bears and enormous herds of bison and bugling elk and wolves and on and on. I mean, I have a chapter in the book on the representation of horses, particularly wild horses in the Northern Rockies. That really begins, I think, probably with Indian artists, but in the Euro-American tradition, the guy who really sets it in motion in the Northern Rockies is John James Audubon. And what I try to do in the chapter on Audubon is to show that he is representing a version of the West in the 1840s. He goes up the Missouri River in 1843. That is kind of similar to, in my chapter and my argument about him, it's similar to what Henry David Thoreau was doing at the same time in Massachusetts, which was trying to recreate, in Thoreau's instance, what Thoreau called an entire heaven and an entire earth, what Massachusetts was like before it had lost many of its big charismatic animals, like moose, for instance. And so Audubon is able to go into the West at a time when all of those creatures are still there. And so he portrays the West as an entire heaven and an entire earth. You don't have to wonder about a landscape in which all the big charismatic animals have been removed, because Audubon portrays for us what that was like. I mean, and he found it so exciting to be amongst those thronging herds of animals. I mean, in some days he would see several thousand animals of 10 or 15 different species at once. That he wrote his wife when he first got to what is now eastern Montana. He said, "I'm so excited I can't write. I can't sit down and write about this. It's so terribly exciting to me."
It is fascinating to see how so many subcultures within the United States have lost the idea that we share the earth with these large animals. I mean, the basically attack, and mostly successful attack on wolves, is something that, to those who love and appreciate wolves, is a just unspeakable tragedy.
That's exactly right. And I think that having worked on this artistic tradition in a part of the West where these charismatic animals have always been held in high regard, and then for the most part were wiped out. I mean, we ended up with a population of grizzly bears in the Northern Rockies, but wolves were completely gone until they were reintroduced into Yellowstone back in the middle of the 1990s. And I think the impression that I came away with from working on this book was that many of the artists were trying to tell us something about these animals. In fact, in that final chapter in the book, What Was Charlie Russell Trying to Tell Us?, one of my arguments in that chapter is that Russell, by talking all the time about what he referred to as Dreamtime Montana. And what he meant by that was Montana the way it had been when he first saw it in the early 1870s. What Charlie Russell was really setting us up for, I think, in our own time, by proclaiming the past to be better than modernity, was a West where we're interested in recovering animals like wolves. And I think of Charlie Russell really as kind of a patron saint for the recovery of animals like wolves under the Endangered Species Act. He sort of sets us up, really, for being ready and able to take that on in our time.
One of the early chapters in your book is about Lewis and Clark. Tell us about what we know and what we don't know about Lewis and Clark and about their effect on the art of this region.
Well, the kind of fun thing that we probably don't think of with respect to Lewis and Clark is that Jefferson did not equip their expedition with an artist. Now, most other expeditions into the West in the 19th century took artists along, and the works of quite a number of them appear in this book. But with Lewis and Clark, all you really have are literary images. And so in order to visualize the West that Lewis and Clark saw, subsequent artists since the time of the actual expedition have had to sit down with their journals and try to recreate visual images from literary description. I mean, and sometimes it's worked and sometimes it hasn't, but I sort of had a lot of fun with this particular chapter because there's clearly a sort of an ideological difference in the way artists portray Lewis and Clark. Many artists, most of whom I think probably are Westerners themselves, or at least symbolic Westerners, tend to think about Lewis and Clark as kind of this entry point of American culture into the continent so that, I mean, there was an old Schoolhouse Rock episode when I was a kid that made me think of this because it was about Lewis and Clark. And it showed Lewis and Clark going up the Missouri River in a canoe, just the two of them, and they were penetrating this black and white world that had no definition at all. But as they went up the river, behind them unfurled all of America in color. All the topography, the rivers, everything sort of in their wake. And that's kind of the way a lot of artists have portrayed Lewis and Clark. But I will admit that the artist whose painting of Lewis and Clark that I really like the best is Thomas Hart Benton, who, of course, is a very famous Missouri artist of the middle of the 20th century, a regionalist artist, as he's known, and something of a modernist. And he did a very wonderful painting of Lewis and Clark called Lewis and Clark at Eagle Creek. And the view is one where Lewis and Clark themselves appear like little gnats down on the river. Way off in the distance, this tiny blip on this screen of a North America that has existed for thousands, hundreds of thousands of years, and, in other words, is not being created as a result of the arrival of Lewis and Clark, but it's a world that's always been there.
We're talking to historian of the West, Dan Flores. You were talking earlier about how the painting of the Northern Rocky Mountains is kind of a masculine set of representations. And, you know, when I looked through the book, when I first opened it and just looked at the pictures, my impression was, okay, cowboys and Indians, buffaloes, wolves, and big, huge landscapes. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that has been underrepresented, which you really bring out in this book, is that there have been a lot of women artists who have taken on this part of the world.
There have been, and I think it's not been known much that there were women artists working in the Northern Rockies. In other words, in a way that's very different from the Southwest, where, of course, people like George O'Keefe and Mary Austin sort of loom large as these figures in Southwestern culture. The Northern Rockies has really sort of come across as this kind of masculine world of big animals, big wilderness. I mean, there's huge wilderness focus in that part of the world that's also different from the Southwest. But I was intrigued by the fact that there were quite a number. I managed to find about a dozen women artists who worked in the Northern Rockies. Now, it's true they didn't become residents of the region much. In other words, they didn't do the thing that Mary Austin and Georgia O'Keeffe and Mabel Dodge Luhan did in the Southwest, which was to move to the region and become sort of spokespeople for the culture. But women were drawn to the place. Quite a number of them, like Catherine Layton, for example, lived in Los Angeles and journeyed to places like Glacier Park every summer. And she did this usually, it was basically the 1920s and 1930s, and painted, for example, she did a whole series of paintings of Grinnell Glacier. One of them, in fact, is on the back of on the back dust jacket of the book. There were women like Elsa Gemney, who lived in Minneapolis, who journeyed out to the Northern Rockies. And so there was kind of this tradition of people, of women artists in particular, who didn't necessarily live in the region, but who would go there and paint, and quite a number of outstanding visual representations emerged from it. But there were some who actually were there, and probably two who are pretty exciting in terms of reading about their lives are a British expatriate photographer, and this book, by the way, does have a lot of photographs in it, a British expatriate photographer named Evelyn Cameron, who, with her naturalist husband, moved to the wilds of darkest Montana in the 1880s, and who left this treasure trove of glass plate negatives, about 5,000 of them, that weren't found until 100 years later, a century
later. Can you imagine finding those things?
It was it's an amazing story. Donna Lucy, writer for Time Life, who was touring the West looking for photographic collections for Time Life books, is the person who discovered these glass plate negatives. And she has a great story of walking into this abandoned ranch house with rattlesnakes buzzing underneath the floorboards,
right,
and being led by this elderly woman, a friend of Evelyn Cameron's when Evelyn had been alive, down into the basement and seeing all these glass plate negatives. So that's really kind of a remarkable story. And one of the things that's remarkable about Evelyn Cameron is that she, too, because she and her husband were naturalists, I mean, they had all these pet animals, pet wolves, pet coyotes, pet eagles. And many of the photographs show them with these animals of that part of the world as their pets. The other woman whose life took a completely different trajectory was a woman named Fray Dana, who was actually trained by Mary Cassatt, who at the turn of the 20th century was the most famous woman painter probably in the West, or in the world, really. And Fray Dana had, I don't know whether I should call it the misfortune, but I think it worked out this way, to marry a rancher who moved her to the Montana-Wyoming border as a young woman. And for several years, she tried to realize her ambition, as she put it, to be famous. But after about 15 years of trying to paint in that isolated part of the West, she basically gave up, produced a small body of work which is held in very high regard today, but the great lament about her life is that she did so little. And so I do a chapter on her where I compare her with Georgia O'Keeffe, who is her contemporary, and who, of course, moved to outback New Mexico, out in the Chama Valley near Abiquiu, middle of nowhere, but who has a very different kind of reaction to living in the outback West.
And on some level, I mean, O'Keeffe chose it. She actually left her marriage rather than followed it, and I'm sure that makes some kind of a difference.
I think it made a difference, and I think there's no question that the two relationships, Fray Dana's relationship with her husband and George O'Keefe's relationship with Albert Stieglitz were very, very different. Stieglitz, of course, was an artist himself, a major photographer, and willing to let O'Keefe, of course, do whatever she wished. I don't think he was all that happy when she began going to New Mexico every summer while he was still alive. But as you say, she was sort of doing this within the context of their marriage. And I think in Fray Dana's case, in fact, there's no question looking at her diaries, she struggled against her husband, who would not let her go back to Paris, would not let her go to New York. And so she finally gave up.
A sad story for women artists and a cautionary tale. Let's talk there's much more to say about this book, Visions of the Big Sky, Painting and Photographing the Northern Rocky Mountain West. But let's talk about your other book, which has been reissued now after 20 years. It's called Caprock Canyonlands, Journeys into the Heart of the Southern Plains. It must be interesting for you looking at a book that was written in what's 20 years ago?
The late 1980s, that's right. Yes. I was basically about 38, 39 years old when I was writing this book.
And so you wrote this book, and we'll talk about it, but now here you are looking at it 20 years later, reissuing it, and trying to figure out whether it stands up, how it stands up, what you would change, although you can't change it because it's a reissue. What was the original motivation for this book? What's it about? What are these Caprock Canyonlands?
Well, like I think a lot of the books I've done, this was a book about a place where I was living. I tend, for whatever the reason, be drawn to whenever I am in a particular place, West Texas in this instance, Montana in the last 20 years. I mean, I'm doing the same thing in New Mexico, working on a book about where I live. I tend to write these kinds of books because I guess I'm kind of fascinated by the world out the door. Maybe it simplifies research, too. You basically are trying to come to grips with the immediate world around you. And so I found myself at a university in West Texas in a region which everyone thought of as a waste place in the American West. I had someone actually say to me when I was doing a reading over here in Santa Fe for that book back in 1991, she said, "Now, where's this book about?" I said, "Well, it's mostly about eastern New Mexico and the panhandle of Texas." And she said, "Oh, my God, ghastly place." Yeah, and so here I am in what the world sort of regards as a ghastly place. But what I discovered was that there was actually a landscape around the perimeter of this gigantic plateau that sort of spills over between the Texas Panhandle and New Mexico that is bordered, has been for a million years, by something like 20 major canyons that comprise the headwaters of a lot of the rivers that flow across the Southwest. The Red River, the Canadian River in New Mexico, the Brazos River in Texas. And I began focusing on that region and over time realized that with a single exception, and it happened to have been George O'Keefe, who had gotten a teaching position in that part of the world back in the 19-teens, and who also had fallen in love with it, I seemed to be the only person who cared about it. And so I began exploring it canyon by canyon, reading everything I could about the geology of it, the history of it, the natural history, the archaeology and anthropology, and attempting to, in effect, kind of provide a natural history of the spirit of place of those canyons. And for want of a better characterization, that's really sort of what the book is.
It's interesting to me because it ties together in some ways with the book that we've just been talking about at the beginning of the show, which is the Visions of the Big Sky, the book about art of the Northern Rocky Mountain West. And one thing that I was thinking about when I was reading through Caprock Canyonlands is that what one person considers ghastly and the next person considers beautiful, and there's a lot of different ways of looking at a landscape, so much of how we see has to do with the art and the literature that has been given to us or that we have encountered about that place. It's not so straightforward to have a one-on-one relationship with the land that's unmitigated by culture and literature and art.
That's exactly right, and that's well said, too. I think there's sort of a general perception out there among writers, painters, photographers, that oftentimes places don't exist in people's minds until some particular writer or painter or photographer has given them a kind of a sense of place. And I sort of dare say in some respects that Caprock Canyonlands kind of did this for that part of the world. And I'll just offer you one example that I've noticed in going back to that region. I don't live there anymore. I've been gone for 20 years. But when I was living there in the early 1880s and working on this book and exploring these canyons, one of the things I noticed in watching the news every night was that the weather people, when they would show you a map of the local area, what they showed you, and this was in West Texas and eastern New Mexico both, were basically the maps of the county outlines. And 20 years later, I think in part as a result of this book, when you watch the news over there these days, they actually show you topographical relief
right on
those maps. It's like until that book appeared, it didn't seem to occur to anyone that there was topography there that was important to know about. And after the appearance of the book, it maybe took a decade or so, there was a gradually dawning realization that, oh yeah, we inhabit actually an ancient landscape, a topographical landscape that's been around us all along. It's just we've not paid any attention to it.
Who was the, I know you know this, and I can't remember the name of the person who made a map of the West whose borderlines, instead of being states, were watersheds. And there was a political movement to divide states up by watersheds instead of those crazy straight lines that we have out here.
Right. It was John Wesley Powell who was the director of the U.S. Geological Survey. And in fact, it's interesting you mention Powell because Powell's kind of a hero of mine and a lot of people who are environmentalists and interested in the West. And one of the reasons we think of Powell as a hero because of this vision is that a lot of us are trying to reimagine the West as natural places rather than places that are bounded by these political boundaries. So, I mean, one of the things that both of these books have in common is that they are about ecoregions in the West, or bioregions is another term that people use, rather than about states. And this is an image that I think comes out of John Wesley Powell. I mean, he's trying to get Americans to think, especially Westerners, to think of themselves as being inhabitants of real places on the landscape rather than these things, than these areas that have been delineated by these linear lines like most of our Western states.
And that's very important. And when you think about it, that kind of political boundary drawing that happened way before anybody who's alive now's memory really influences the way we see the land. One of the things that was interesting in Caprock Canyonlands was the great difference between Texas and New Mexico in the way people see the land.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the region I was writing about in this book is a plateau, actually a series of plateaus and eastern-facing escarpments. It's the Llano Estacado. El Llano Estacado is the primary plateau that spills from the panhandle over into eastern New Mexico. And the Canadian escarpment is the second one. In the chapters of this book that deal with West Texas as opposed to New Mexico, I mean, there's absolutely no question that there's a major difference. I mean, it's a difference that you can actually see flying over the state boundary in an airplane from 20,000 feet. You can look down and you can see precisely flying from Albuquerque to Austin, say, where the Texas boundary begins, because land use patterns are so different on either side of the border. And it's played out in the resulting 20 years since this book has been published, because one of the probably the principal argument that Caprock Canyonlands makes is for the preservation of these canyon landscapes as natural areas, particularly inspired by the National Park Service's attempt to create first a national park of the plains in the region in the early 1930s, and later a very large national monument in the area, neither of which came to fruition. And the result today, I mean, this I was calling in 1990 for our revisiting this idea of creating a big national park out on the southern plains. It's not happened since the book was published, but one of the things that has happened is that the state parks on the Texas side have grown rather dramatically, probably a little bit as a result of the book creating a more receptive audience for nature preservation. On the New Mexico side, though, the difference is that we actually have gotten a federal wilderness in this canyonland area. It's the Sabinoso Wilderness. Senator Tom Udall introduced this as an idea a couple of years ago, and in the Omnibus Wilderness Bill of the spring of 2009, we actually got the new Sabinoso Wilderness in the mouth of the Canadian River Gorge. And so, although there's no federal wilderness on the Texas side, the New Mexico side of this canyonland country has been willing to embrace the idea of wilderness.
And even in Texas, there has been some progress. And as I think you mentioned in the book, there's something to be said for taking lots of little small steps. You know, a few hundred acres here, a few hundred acres there, it starts to add up.
That's right. Since the book was published in 1990 when it originally came out, Palo Duro Canyon State Park was at about 14,000 acres. It's now up to more than 30,000 acres as the Texas Parks and Wildlife Division has added three ranches as they've come up for sale on the southern boundary of the park. They've acquired three ranches and added those to this park. And so what I was calling for back in the early 1990s was the federal government revisiting the region with the thought of a national monument or a national park there. What the State Parks Division in Texas is creating is sort of a state version, I think, and the hope that many of us have is that this process can continue. There is another park about 45 miles south of Palo Duro called Caprock Canyon State Park, and some of the absolute most dramatic canyons anywhere in the Southwest are in between those two parks. And so what I've been holding out is that we will gradually end up getting places like Tule Canyon, which is kind of the Yosemite of the Southern Plains, added to this gradual accretion and park acreage there.
Dan Flores is a historian of the West. He's professor at the University of Montana at Missoula. And this Saturday, the 12th of June, he will be at Garcia Street Books at 3 in the afternoon, talking about his new book, Visions of the Big Sky, Painting and Photographing the Northern Rocky Mountain West, and Caprock Canyonlands, Journeys into the Heart of the Southern Plains. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santaferadiocafe.org, thanks to Dot Foil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.